Welcome to the Whiskey Congress. Honest, open talk dedicated to speaking the truth to those who are open to hearing it. Black, white, right, left. Most importantly, honest, bold, and fueled by good whiskey. In Whiskey Veritas, we are Whiskey Congress. Join the evolution.
Welcome back to Whiskey Congress. I'm excited today, Steve, because we have a whiskey to review that is hard to find these days.
Yeah, for us, it's definitely hard to find.
Do you know why Ohio gets the...
I don't know.
I mean, certainly it's a small barrel, you know, small batch bourbon that's hard to find probably everywhere, but it seems like Ohio...
Well, I mean, Kentucky somehow,
I don't know.
You know, talking to other people I know in the whiskey world, it all depends on the whiskey. I know there are some places, I think people in PA and people in New York can get it relatively regularly. But I know we just have a hard time getting it here. You know, like I have a couple places that I go to and they only have it, you know, for short stretches. And you know, maybe, you know, 2 months out of the year, maybe.
Well, I drove by a liquor store that, you know, was not in, I mean, it's right around the corner from here, so I don't want to criticize the neighborhood too much, but it's a kind of liquor store where everything is behind glass. And
they sell a lot of Hennessy.
A lot of Hennessy, not a lot of Blantons. Okay, right. This is the big reveal. We're drinking Blantons.
Right.
We scored a bottle of Blantons. I'm excited. I mean, we've had it before, but yeah, it's just really good.
We've had it before. We haven't reviewed it. I don't think we've actually talked about it on the show other than the fact that we have consumed it at some point or another. And, you know, that's a good find. That's a good, you know, random find in that, you know, in that particular store. Because I've been in that store before and never really paid attention. I think I stopped in there just to grab beer for a party we were having or something like that. So,
it could be the oasis of rare whiskeys.
Yeah, I definitely need to go in there and check because there's a couple bottles that I'm trying to track down, different bottles of scotch and things like that. And I'm having a tough time finding them locally. And I do have an online source of finding hard to get alcohols. The problem is
I pay a pretty
price. And so in order to make it worth it, I have to buy, you know, three or four bottles, which, you know, now, you know, you're talking $400 in booze.
Right. It's a car payment.
Right. And then another $100 in shipping and everything else, because it's probably coming from Europe. And so if I can avoid that and I can just buy the actual bottle that I'm looking for here locally, that would be ideal. But I need the state to cooperate with me and get the booze to, you know, the distributors here locally and whatever.
So before we talk presentation, the presentation of this bottle is really cool.
Yeah. What's that shape? Is that an octa?
It's not an octagon.
Octapolygon? Right.
I do not know what to call that.
It's some form of a polygon that's kind of, I don't want to say grenade-shaped, but
it's kind of grenade-shaped.
It's a short, stubby bottle with, I don't know how many edges. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Yeah, octa, whatever.
Right. So it's a really neat bottle, though.
So the stoppers have a letter on them.
Yeah.
And apparently they spell Blantons. This one's a T, I believe.
That's
T,
okay.
And so people... apparently collect, like, they want the whole thing, which is cool, but I'm not that into collecting stoppers.
Well, I have three.
What do you got?
Well, I have a T? Well, I have two N's and an S.
I'd like to buy a vowel.
You know, so Vanna White is 61, by the way?
I didn't know that number, but I knew she was around there, and she looks amazing, doesn't she?
Well, yeah, I mean, even
461.
Even with the HD 4K TV... I flipped on it the other day and saw Vanna White, and then I was like, how old is she? And I looked it up, and not because she looked old, it's just like she's been on TV for
doing that job since I was like 7 years old.
Right, like as long as I can fucking remember TV, Vanna White's been on it, you know, with big head Pat Sajak. So, but to the whiskey.
Yes.
Blanton's, for whiskey and especially for bourbon lovers, Blanton's I think holds kind of a special place. When you go to flavor, it is of the bourbons, it's a drier bourbon, with a nice smooth finish. There is a sweetness to it, but, that wood taste really comes through.
It's almost like a cherry wood to me. Is that?
No, I'm pretty sure they go with oak.
Well, I'm sure. I'm just saying right. It has a flavor to, in my mouth. I don't know. It's what I... detect. I'm 100% sure it's charred oak.
Right. Yeah. It's got a really smooth finish, and it's I believe it's a 93 proof.
You are correct. I'm looking
at well. And so with a 93 proof, there you don't have that aggressive alcohol burn
that you get
with some of your, you know, with your higher proof bourbons. You know, I believe Blanton's, I don't know the age, and I think because...
I don't think it has an age statement. I don't know.
It doesn't have an age statement, and I think what they do is I think they use a couple different aged bourbons, if I'm not mistaken.
It's a single barrel.
It's a single barrel, yes.
But it's mixed with other things that are mixed in there.
Maybe. But I'm not sure. I know it doesn't have an age statement, so I can't tell you how long it's aged for. But it's got to be for an extended period of time with the alcohol, with the proof that high. So,
right.
You know, I have to guess it's probably... You know, probably over 7 years, probably in the realm of 10 to 12.
I would guess you're correct. Ready for the numbers?
Yeah, you want to go first?
Up to you.
All right. Well, I gave it a 94.
Look at that.
Revealing the card, a 94.
Look at that. I'm starting to get it.
Very little starting to get it.
Good for you.
I've learned so much from you, Steve.
I'm not
going to lie to you. I'll even say this on the air, even though it pains me to do so. Drinking good whiskeys like we have been for the last several months, my 10 high is just not tasting as good.
Really?
And fuck you. And I was like, for the really? Record, and fuck you.
Shocking.
No, I mean, it's. I stand by my original statements. It's a for the dollar, it is fantastic. When you're making a Manhattan with it, you shouldn't use high-end whiskey. I'd rather make a Manhattan with that than... Jim Beam or Jack Daniels
what
or anything like that.
What the hell is your reasoning for that? That makes no sense.
What do you mean?
When you're making a Manhattan, you don't use a high-end whiskey?
I don't... If I made a Blanton's Manhattan and you didn't punch me in the face, I'd be disappointed in you.
The way you make them, yeah, I would absolutely punch you in the face. But
you're
thank you. If you're making a good quality Manhattan, you absolutely use a high-end... You use a high-end bourbon, absolutely.
No, you don't... All right, we're going to disagree on that because one of my friends on Facebook... I posted that I scored a bottle of this. She said, make an old fashioned with it. And I got multiple friends messaging me without her knowledge of it saying, if you mix that, I will unfriend you and deny knowing you.
Okay. So
that was an old fashioned, not a Manhattan. But
I mean, even still.
So much sugar, so much. It just takes away. You. If I made you a Maker's Mark Manhattan or a Blanton's Manhattan, the difference would be minuscule.
Disagree.
Okay,
and I'll take you to a place here in Cleveland, the Velvet Tango Room, and I guarantee. We talked to Paulius, the owner, and I guarantee you he will disagree with you 100%. And then he'll give you a Manhattan to make you eat your fucking words. And not only that, I won't let you eat the cherry.
Oh, that's that fancy,
their cherries
dark
are
cherry
amazing.
that yeah. Really okay. Well, I will be eating the cherry. We both scored it a 94. It is fantastic bourbon.
Yes, it is.
And all right, so let's get on to my second favorite subject, bashing the NRA. I did a YouTube post
easy,
about...
Easy, big fella.
You know, here's the thing. I want to say this as clearly as I can. You know me. Most people who listen long enough know I'm a gun owner. I'm a hunter.
If you're watching this on YouTube right now,
you
I
see
mean,
a
there's
fucking...
A, there's
which,
a...
in its day, that was an assault rifle. That is a .303 British Enfield. Enfield. In 1918, that was an assault rifle.
What's the magazine capacity there?
5 or 6?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's not detachable, and it's a bolt-action rifle. Things have changed a little bit. And anyway, I did a YouTube rant about this because I know AR-15s and AR-15-style rifles are not the problem in and of themselves. However... I stand by my statement that there is absolutely no reason for a civilian to use them for home defense or sporting purposes. They are terrible choices for either of those things. I will also repeat that no one...
I guess it depends on your home.
No, it doesn't. Unless you have a 100-yard hallway in your
home. I mean, if you have a big enough home, right? Like, I mean, if you have a home with a big staircase or something like that, I'm upstairs and whatever. I mean, I get what you're saying.
No, it's a terrible choice for a home defense.
It also depends on who has it. I mean, who's firing
a shotgun is way, way, way better for... All right, so I mean, we could discuss tactical weaponry.
But I mean,
it's a dumb choice for home defense. Period. AR-15s are
someone who's efficient with it will tell you to fuck off. They can do it just fine.
I'm not saying you couldn't use it and make it. I mean, it's good at killing people, which is what it's designed to do.
Okay,
but
again, so what?
Okay,
so what are we talking about?
What are we talking about? An AR-15 is more likely to go through a wall when fired. So if you're trying not to hurt other people that are outside of your area, it's a very high velocity round. Ricochets are a big issue.
Doesn't necessarily have to be.
It's not. Again, you could use it, and if you were under certain circumstances, it could make sense. It could be effective. But when you're logically choosing what to defend your home with, a pump shotgun is the best choice.
I agree with you.
All right,
fully. I'm just giving you a hard time. Just calm down.
All right. I'm not going to calm down because fuck the NRA.
But here's the thing. Here's the problem. Nobody wants to calm down, right? Everyone is having this conversation based off of emotion, right? Whether you're pro-gun or anti-gun or whatever your position is, or you're somewhere in the middle, a lot of it is fueled by emotion. And so, knowing that we're going to get into this conversation, what my request of you, and when we have this conversation, is let's not get caught in the emotion of it. Let's not get caught in your disdain for the NRA and Wayne LaPierre. Let's drive this based off of what we know.
Okay. But maybe I was passionate, but I was also using logic.
I'm not, but okay. It doesn't take long to get off.
Okay. But what I was saying was logical, that if you're saying you need that gun,
by the way, it doesn't take long to get off.
That's a personal problem I'm working on, Steve.
The ladies will thank you.
Yes. But people who say that's why they have it, they're making a poor choice. This gun is designed for one very specific purpose. And I'm not saying ban them. I'm just saying don't give me the bullshit argument that, I use it for hunting. Okay, if you do, frankly, you're making a poor choice. If you're using it for home defense, it's a poor choice. If you just like shooting it, that's fine. I mean, I personally would say that the level of ease that these things bring to mass shootings, especially with large cap magazines, is a detriment to the safety of our society. That doesn't mean, again, I'm not saying ban anything. I'm being logical. Go ahead.
Perfect example of what you're saying, what you're trying to say. One of my training partners is a Special Forces, Green Beret, Army guy. He's done multiple tours, Iraq, Afghanistan. And he has an M4 of his own, right? Which is the actual assault rifle version of an AR-15. It's a little bit more compact, but it's not semi-automatic. It's fully automatic.
Okay, you need special license for that, which you should.
Right, and he has.
Yeah, sure. I'm not. Yeah.
And so, but what he said to me, this was Wednesday morning. Because I was benching, yes. And, we were talking about that shooting, and he said, let me tell you this. He's like, what I do for a living. He's like, I go overseas, and I hunt people, and I kill people for a living. That's my job. That's what I do. He said, I would give up my guns in a heartbeat if it meant that not another kid got killed. And he said, I'll tell you this. I'll give up my M4 and my AR. And like he went through a list of weapons that he has at home, which I'm like, you've got two small boys, but okay. He said, I'll give them all up because if they want to ban those, then go ahead. Because I'll tell you my experience is in a live fire situation, I have a much better chance of survival with a person who's shooting a handgun, even if they're very efficient with that handgun, firing and reloading. I have a much better chance of living in that situation than I do with a person with anything from an AR-15 and up style weapon, right? That just assault style weapon. Right. I'm not calling an AR-15 an assault weapon because semantics, blah, blah, blah. But he said, even with the AR-15, even though it's a single shot, just the style and design of the weapon and the ability to fire, which the speed that your ability to fire, even without a bump stock, still, it's very hard to get away from that particular weapon in those particular situations. And if you limit people to handguns or shotguns, then people will have a much better chance of survival in those mass shooting sort of situations.
And another difference is that the, right. the caliber...
And this is coming, and this is come, this is literally coming from basically the modern day version equivalent of real life version equivalent of Captain America. Right, he's okay. got he's got a giant, you know, American flag tattoo on his left arm. He's got a giant tattoo of Ohio and U.S. soldier across his back. Like he is America. He voted for Trump. That's what, you know, my lifting partner is. He is, you know, as conservative as they come, except for his passionate love of hip hop and rap music. But that's a whole different conversation. But I mean, he said, "Listen, I'll give up my guns, and I'll tell you that taking AR-15s away from people is a good idea because, for this particular reason, right? The people that are pissed because they can't have an AR-15 anymore, it's worth dealing with them to save the lives of these kids in these schools."
Okay, I'm glad your friend said that. The other thing that gets missaid is. The round fired by the 223 round is going about 3,300 feet a second versus a 9mm is going about 1,000 feet a second. So the velocity causes wounds that are far more severe than a lower velocity handgun. Even though handguns account for, you know, 5-10 times the number of gunshot injuries, the likelihood of survival of a handgun bullet wound is way, way higher than...
And Listen, we can solve for two things at once, right? The handgun problem is a problem, but kids getting, like, people deciding that they're going to take an AR-15 and go shoot up schools. Yes, if you look at the numbers, it only happens this finite number of times, and there's only been this number of lives that have been taken by these particular rifles. You know, like, I think there's a total of, like, 10 times that account for AR-15 mass shootings and everything else. That's still, it's still a problem,
right? AR-15s are essentially idiot-proof. They're much easier to point and shoot.
Aside from that, though, let's just think this through, right? Because the argument is going to be, you know, people are going to go to more people are killed with knives, more people are killed with X and Y, right. car crash. You know,
coconuts
the
big falling out of trees.
The big thing is, you know, the big thing is more people die in car crashes every year than they do, you know, by gunfire. So, you know, by that logic, we should take away cars, or people should only be limited to one car, or they should only be limited to whatever car kills the least number of people. And obviously that's a pivot point. It's a false equivalency on so many different levels. So this idea that, you know, because AR-15s only account for, you know, so many deaths and it's a small number and it just so happens to be in schools and people are emotional about that, we shouldn't look at getting rid of them. It's ridiculous, right? I mean, and to your point is, it's not an efficient weapon to use for home defense. You wouldn't use it for hunting. So what do you really have it for? Now, just be honest why you have it.
Right.
Right. The reason why you have it is because gun ownership is a lifestyle. Yes. Gun ownership, the people who own a large number of guns, right? Some of it is for hunting. Some of it is for home defense. But some people, they get them because they like them. They like to collect them. They like to take them to the range. They like to play, you know, G.I. Joe in these non-live fire situations, right, where no one's actually shooting back at them.
Which makes it a lot easier, by the way.
Which does make it a lot easier, but they do it because there is a lifestyle component that goes with it, right? And so the reality is we need to look at this from that perspective, right? Because you do have a group of people who are responsible gun owners, right, who aren't criminals, who aren't bad guys, they obey the law, and, you know, they don't have mental illness and all this other stuff, and they get the guns because they enjoy them, they like them, there's a you know, sexiness to them, there's a coolness factor, power, whatever, and, you know, like, people collect baseball cards, like people collect cars, like people collect whatever they collect, you know, there's the same group of people with guns. The issue is that this particular thing that they collect, if in the wrong hands, can end lives, right? And so we
much
have
more
to,
efficiently than the
right,
other,
right? Yeah. And so we have to balance the whole idea of the lifestyle gun owner against the person who picks up a gun and decides that they're going to solve their problems by going and killing people.
Yes, right? Yes,
and apparently we have to do it because they're killing, you know, young white kids. We really don't need to solve it if they're killing, if people are killing each other off in the hood, right? Because that shit's been going on.
Well, that's black kids killing black kids.
Right. I mean, the only reason we talk about that is if we're going to talk about it in reference to, you know, shut down liberals, right? Like the only time conservatives talk about fucking Chicago is if they're mad at liberals, yeah. right? But they would never go there and actually do anything about it.
My girl Dana Loesch was all over that. Like, why don't we see more pictures of black mothers crying? So she said something effective.
So go through the exact situation. So at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference or whatever, Dana Loesch, who is a representative of the NRA, gets up there in front of the congregation and says that the media loves mass shootings because
they love the ratings.
They love the ratings, and it's crying white mothers. Crying white mothers drive ratings. She's not wrong.
True.
And then
she said crying white mothers are gold.
Gold. Okay, fine. But I mean, their ratings gold. And then she says, but this type of shit happens almost every day in Chicago, and there's no town halls. You know, there's no big CNN town halls about the violence in Chicago. What about those black crying mothers, right? And again, she's not wrong, right? She's dead right. She's absolutely right, and we've talked about it on this show. This shit happens all the time in Chicago, in Cleveland, St. Louis, D.C., Baltimore, right? And yet there are no town halls. There's no one, like, it's got to be Vice or some other, you know, kind of alternative left media that goes out and they cover it, but they don't have the same sort of viewership as a CNN, an MSNBC, Fox News, blah blah blah, go on and on and on down the line. So she makes these statements, right? And two things can be right at once. What she said was absolutely right. The media does like these because they are ratings gold, and they're not going to do it in Chicago because they don't care, because they don't drive the ratings. But my rebuttal to Dana Loesch would be, well, then take your ass down there to Chicago, bring your ass here to Cleveland, and you have a town hall about this violence, because the gun violence there is part of the problem against the NRA. If you guys got involved and said, hey, let's figure out a way to stop the violence and the gun violence that's going on, then listen, you would have a much more credible voice in this argument, but you don't.
And part of the reason they don't is pointing to the scary ghetto and the scary government is what makes the NRA so much more powerful financially, right? They tell people, you need to protect yourself. You're not safe.
You need to protect yourself from that scary ghetto where they have all these guns and all this violence. We can't control the guns that they have.
Right.
But you can control yourself having a gun.
And they will make the truthful statement that Illinois has very restrictive gun laws. True, but it's really easy to drive a gun across the border from Indiana to Illinois. Yes, these guns are being purchased illegally. Yes, it's true that the number of murders being committed by legally registered firearms or firearms in the hands of NRA members are probably low. Okay.
There's no probably about it. They are.
Okay.
Right. And again, that's another part of, I mean, and so this is, again, it's a complex problem, right? Because the people who legally.
Chicago Obama. There, I solved it.
The reason, the people who go out, who go to Cabela's and buy their guns and they go through the gun check and they walk out with their weapon and then they take it to the gun range and they, you know, they have it in a case and they've got it in a lockbox that's biometrically controlled and all that other stuff. You know, those aren't the people that are committing the crimes that the NRA is crying about, and that, you know, people, when they talk about the violence everywhere, those aren't the people who are committing these crimes, right?
True.
Now, when you start to dissect it, though, when you look at domestic violence, where, you know, I mean, like, there's, you have the numbers with domestic violence and, you know, the men who, you know, end up shooting their wives and or their girlfriends in those sort of situations, then all of a sudden things get skewed. Right. And then that's where, again, it's a complex issue and you're not going to just solve it by, you know, solving for one thing. And this is a massive problem beyond algebra, beyond solving for X. Right. I mean, now we're into like advanced super calculus.
Right. And I mean, you could
like I tapped out a calculus one.
I had to go through four.
You're stupid. I wouldn't do that.
I was an engineer. I had to do that shit. And I sucked at three and four. Sucked big time. But anyway, I mean, I've expressed my disdain for the NRA because I think that they use fear tactics, use this drummed up bullshit to basically drive money into their pockets, which then flick back larger politicians. Well,
the biggest issue is that they drive money into the politician's pocket, therefore handcuffing the politicians because the politicians won't vote against the person that's putting money in their pocket. That's the biggest issue. That to me, that's bigger than, you know, the way they promote all that other stuff. Because if the NRA wasn't driving money in the politician's pocket, but they did all things the same, then we would be having a completely different conversation, because politicians would then be free to make better decisions and have better conversations in Congress about how to handle this, right? Like, then there wouldn't be this, they wouldn't be afraid of the backlash. They're not really afraid of the backlash. What they're afraid of is the NRA dollars not flowing into their pockets.
Speaking of which, NRA dollars flowing into the NRA took a bit of a hit this week, because multiple organizations, starting with the First National Bank of Omaha and the Enterprise Rental Car Group.
Right, which is massive, because, is, I mean, that's almost, I mean, the Enterprise Rental Car Group is
Avis Budget, and it, or it's three of them.
Enterprise, Avis, National, a couple that I've never heard of. I'm like, you must be able to only get those in, like, Tijuana or some shit. But I think there's a total of five rental car companies under the Enterprise Rental Group, and they all pulled out.
And they are privately held entities.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the big deal is they don't have to report to a board of directors. In the last couple of days, a lot of publicly traded entities have severed ties with the NRA, and the NRA has shot back with their typical "you hate freedom" bullshit.
Right. We don't need you. We've got guns.
Right. But, you know, when the money starts to dry up, this is going to get interesting. And I would love to see a logic-based, civilian-driven gun organization that said, we care about protecting your Second Amendment rights, and we care about trying to make the streets safer. We can't achieve zero risk. We know this. But, boy, it would be nice to have a logic-based organization out there. And it's probably the whiskey kicking in that I think that that's a possibility.
Yeah, I can't see how you don't end up back with the NRA where it is today, based off the way the system is set up. You would have to what's really solves this is being able to you have to pull the money out of politics. You have to pull the money out of politics, right? I mean, you have to create a law that says you can't, you know, these organizations can't donate these massive amounts of money. They're, you know what I mean? Like, you can only or limit it. Right, you have to limit it, and then you have to figure out.
And be transparent about it.
Right, and you have to look at the loopholes. Right, I mean, you can't limit it, but the problem is that some of these places say, "Oh, we can only donate so much." Wink, wink, and then they just start firing off shell organization after shell organization to donate, you know, whatever the max is. Right, you know, you say, "All right, you can only donate $10,000." All right, well, Stephen Jim Corp, Stephen Jim Enterprises, Stephen Jim whatever, and then all of a sudden, you know, like, all these different shell organizations start popping up and donating money. So that's how you solve for it, though, is you pull the money out of politics, and then that limits the control that these different organizations and these companies, whether it's the NRA or the Koch brothers or
George Soros,
environmental groups,
George
whatever.
Soros, the one the Republicans hate,
right? I mean, and you neutralize that, and now all of a sudden these politicians have to do their job based off of the people that put them in office, and not the people who put money in their pocket.
Because people get elected, especially legislative officials, get elected largely based on donors, not based on voters. If you have more money than your opponent, you can generally flood TV with ads, and you get elected
TV, flood radio, social media, internet, all of it. And that's a big part of the problem.
It is a huge part of the problem. All right, I won't bash the NRA anymore for the next at least 45 to 50 seconds. All right, you got to handle this one, the next one, brother.
All right, so switching gears. Black Panther has just really taken off beyond expectations. It did a massive first 4 days. I think the estimates were about $230 to $235 million for the first 4 days, making it the largest of the Marvel movies in a four-day span, and then putting it like in the top five all-time movies in a four-day span, not adjusted for inflation. And the response has been, I think, somewhat remarkable on a lot of different levels. And the reason is, while this frustrates a lot of people, the reason why this response is so remarkable is for the longest, I mean, it was all black cast, all right, save for two people. And a movie with an all black cast with this sort of magnitude in this day and age shows kind of where we are as a society, that we have evolved. Now, there are reminders that we haven't because of the backlash from different pockets and the, you know, anger, vitriol. And we talked about last week, we talked about some of the responses where, you know, people were lying, giving it bad ratings or saying that violence was breaking out where it wasn't. You know, none of those have been, you know, proven to be true. You know, we have people like, you know, Ben Shapiro coming out and he just can't, you know, get over the fact that this movie with all these black people is getting all this attention and it shouldn't for all these different reasons.
That's not what he said. He said it's showing things that aren't he has now seen the movie, admitted it's a good movie, and now he's doing the whole, well, this is great, but utopias don't really exist and integrated societies are better than, he is in full meltdown mode, and it's absolutely hilarious. Right.
Which okay.
I love it.
Now, you hate Ben Shapiro. He's neutral on me. I
truly
don't.
Hate is not a word I would use. Okay. I have a strong... All right, fine. I hate him.
Stop. Right? Like, what the fuck are you doing?
All right. No,
right?
Like, you hate the guy. I do not like Ben Shapiro.
You know, I mean,
all.
Like, you don't like him. I a lot of these people don't get under my skin as much as they do you, and I'm not sure why you let them get... I mean, like, a lot of these guys are... actors. And Ben Shapiro is a kid.
I don't think he's an actor.
And that's the other problem. I mean, how old is Ben Shapiro?
I would guess mid-30s, low to mid-30s.
I think he's younger than I am.
Yeah.
Like, right. I think he's...
33, 34, you're right, 36, I mean, right? 37? Right.
I'm 37.
Huh. We were 10 years apart, now you're 9, so I'm only 9 years older than you now. Here's my beef with Ben Shapiro.
I love that. You're 37. Like, yeah, bitch, you're still 47.
I'm 46. Okay. See? I got okay. A couple months.
Whatever.
A couple months. The decade.
You're a lot closer to your AARP card than
I am. I'm
going to
be dead much sooner than you, yes.
For a couple of different reasons.
Yeah. Blanton's being one of them. Not your fault, Blanton's. No, my serious beef with Ben Shapiro is, and maybe if I sat down and had a drink with him, I have my Blanton's, he'd have his white wine spritzer.
Does he even drink?
I don't know. I don't give a fuck. My beef with him is he actually isn't like an Alex Jones, Rush Limbaugh psycho. So he makes, again, often technically true statements that are very deceptive and that they fuel the people who don't want to think into believing the bullshit he throws out there, and they give a justification to defending racist or other dishonest philosophies and policies. The number one I'm going to give is he always says the problem in the black community is not systemic racism. It's out of wedlock births and single parent families. Okay, you're right. If every family was the Huxtables, that would be better. But that dismisses the entire narrative of other real shit that's going on out there. And it gives people who want to deflect from realities and just lets them say, oh, well, Ben Shapiro said it's about...
it's actually not true or accurate.
What's not true or accurate?
If you actually look at the numbers of, like, the number of single-family homes, if you look at the real numbers, based... Even if you do it based off of percentages, like, the white people, you guys dwarf us. In terms of single family, you know, dad's out of the picture, parents are divorced, the whole fucking thing. Like, the numbers are staggering, like, in y'all's favor, even when you adjust for percentages and populations and all the numbers.
White power.
Like, you guys are actually... the numbers are wrong. Like, people are using that as a talking point.
That's my point.
But it's not an accurate or true one.
And, all right, even if it was a true one, it still wouldn't change the fact that there are a whole bunch of systemic things that impact black people and people of lower economic situations.
Right. Now, listen. So that's my beef. Let me also say that young black men being thrown in jail at ridiculously high rates, you know, for, you know, adjusted for population is also a major problem, you know, which creates a large number of, you know, single parent homes and things like that. And that number of single parent homes is going up. But I mean, just look at, you know, like, so essentially the rate for divorce for black families is much lower, I shouldn't say much, but it's lower than it is for white. Right, like white people have a higher rate for divorce, right? And so when you take that and then you look at, you know, well, is the father involved in the children's lives? And when you start to look at it and how you adjust for that based on their level of involvement, then the numbers actually, you start to see that, you know, the black family structure isn't as, you know, decentralized as it's made out to be in the media. It's a problem, but it's a problem globally. and not just amongst black families. It's highlighted with black families, but it's a growing problem amongst all families. And the focus on the black family is a talking point for conservatives and for liberals to a point who aren't actually looking and digging into the numbers.
And look, deadbeat dads are not good, not helping their children. Obvious. Black, white, doesn't matter. I know many deadbeat dads who are white. I actually don't know a whole lot of deadbeat dads who are black. But they exist. I know people who deal with that. And they exist in, you know, probably comparable numbers. But I will also say, I know lots of single...
So here's...
Hold on,
here's,
let me finish this. I know multiple black and white single dads who knocked up someone being sexually irresponsible, whatever, who do a pretty good job as fathers. I mean, they might not be married to their, you know, their baby's mother, but they are involved in their kids' lives. They do, you know, I mean, is it, like I said, it's not the perfect ideal.
Your parents divorced?
Yes.
My dad's dead.
Your dad is but passed. Your parents were
divorced, right?
When I was 21.
Okay.
So a little different. I was.
Yeah, you were older.
Yeah.
And are you the youngest?
No, I'm the middle. My brother is 4 years younger than me. Okay. And that was a big
issue for him.
Yeah, it was. And it dated back years. I mean, my parents talked about getting divorced the first time when I was like 10. And in 1981, divorced parents were, it was a scandal if parents got divorced.
Yeah.
Now, by the time we got to the mid 90s, it was almost at a 30% rate and it was no longer scandalous. And now the rate, regardless of race, is about like 50%. Right. I mean, marriages fail more often than they last. And I've got friends who, again, they had kids, they got divorced, but you know, it's a challenge having a separated family. I'm not encouraging that as the ideal mold, but friends who deal with that situation, love their kids, care about their kids, and work with their former spouse to make the best of things.
Right. And I guess before we get back to Black Panther.
How do we...
Right. But, well, I mean, because it all matters, right?
Yeah.
And before we get back to Black Panther, the one thing that I you know, that needs to be focused on is that, you know, when we're talking about issues with the black community, we have to realize and people need to remember that you're also talking, like, there are things, like, I think there are issues with racism and it'll never be a perfect world, but we're always going to have certain problems. But if you actually, again, look at the numbers, right, 80% of the black population is doing just fucking fine. You know, I mean, that's a whole lot of us, right? We're doing fine. We're educated. We're working in the private sector, working in the public sector. Maybe we have worked in both. you know, we're entrepreneurs. We're athletes and entertainers and everything else. Doctors and lawyers and accountants and bartenders and waitresses and everything else. So there's plenty of good examples. Most of us are doing just fine. But for those of us who are not, right, there is a percentage of us who are not, and they're having a tough time. There's a lot of reasons why that there is a you know, whether the number is 20%, 30%, 15%, whatever it is, that are having a really tough time. But again, if you look at the white population, there's Appalachia, right? Appalachia fucking sucks. There's a lot of crime there. There's a lot of single mothers. There's a lot of drug use. There's a lot of violence and all that other shit, right?
There's Parma.
So right.
Parma is a suburb of Cleveland. I want to explain to the people who know what I'm talking about. It's a lower income suburb, very close to here, and it's not exactly...
Listen, we know some good people in Parma.
Though. I know.
Tom Licks lives in Parma.
That's right. Tom Licks does live in Parma. And look, again...
Tom Licks, the CEO of Cleveland Whiskey.
We need to talk to him again. I want more Cleveland Whiskey. It's not as good as Bland.
We can just go buy it.
Yeah, we could. But he's a cool guy, too. Anyway, there are urban, lower-income white communities as well that have some good and bad in their communities.
Right. And so... I guess we need to, when we're having this conversation, remember that we're talking about, you know, we're talking about some of the fringe parts of these communities, right? Like, I mean, we're talking, or not, I'm sorry, not the fringe part of these, but we're talking about smaller percentages of, you know, of the African-American community, the black community, that has serious problems that need to be rectified, because when you're only as strong as your weakest link, and, you know, the urban black community is a weak link in the overall society, and we have to get that resolved. But at the same time, let's not lump everybody into, you know what I mean? Like, and what I mean is, I can't sit here and say that I am having the same problems as someone who, you know, lives on, you know, lives over, you know, actually where my office is, you know, that lives at 79th and Kinsman, who, you know, who's going to a school that doesn't have books, that doesn't have heat, that has mold, that has broken glass, that has a teacher who doesn't care, you know, who's, you know, maybe they have both their mom and dad, but their mom and dad work, you know, crazy hours, or, you know, they work a couple jobs at fast food places, or maybe the dad is in jail. Like, I don't have that same situation. And there is a percentage of our people who have that problem, but that's not the majority of us. And so, again, these are complex issues, and we can't just talk globally about any of this stuff. We have to dig down into the deeper details and the deeper numbers if we really want to look at and start to resolve some of these problems. Now, going back to Black Panther, the big part of this is I didn't get to see it this weekend. Now, the reason why I didn't get to see it this weekend is I've talked about my dog, Dora. Dora's been a part of our show from time to time. She had the stinky farts that kind of smoked Jim out.
That was brutal.
Or a couple times we recorded at my house, and she usually sat under our table.
Snored a few times.
And she would fall asleep and snore or kick me or Jim. She was always by my side. She was always by my daughter's side. And I had to put her down this weekend. She fell and broke her leg. My mom came to catch a flight, and she was excited to see my mom. She slipped, and her leg came from underneath her, and she landed on it. And I had to take her to the vet. And, you know, she was older. She was 13. She had some early stages of bone cancer. And, you know, so she just wasn't going to have a good quality of life. So I had to make a hard decision there. And I did. So I didn't make it to see Black Panther, and that's why. So that being said, I don't have an overall critique of the movie, and I don't have a good critique of the movie yet, but I will get to see it. And the way this movie is going, I don't think it'll come too late, because it is just, you know, breaking records. It is, you know, just making the type of money that it needed to make, because they spent a shitload of money to make it. And again, it's just good. I mean, you know, you got an all-black cast, and people have decided that apparently it doesn't matter. You know, you make a good movie, you hype it up the right way, and people will go see it. I'm excited to see it. I have my thoughts on it. You know, having read the comic book, though, I have a good perspective on what the story is going to be. So some of my critiques are more for Stan Lee overall with the world that he created. And God, I wish I could, I had an opportunity to talk to Stan Lee. I hope, I don't know how I'll make it happen, but I would love to talk to him before he passes on. But,
So let me just say, I love Dora too. I'm sorry for your loss. Dora was, yeah, the first two times I came to your place, she scared the shit out of me, but pretty quickly warmed up to me.
Well, 100-pound Rottweiler will do that to
you. Yeah, she but within a few visits, she would literally like run up to me and like turn sideways, just like, you know, want to snuggle and
rub get me, petted, love rub me,
right,
rub me,
and
love
she,
me.
She was awesome. So I did love your dog, and I'm really sad that she passed away. And so you had one more thing well, about
Here's my other thing, right? Like, so there's some white people that are just real, that cannot get over Black Panther, right? Like, their whole thing is that it's not real, and utopian society, and it doesn't exist, and
Ben Shapiro,
like, great, that whole fucking thing, right? And it's just like, all right, cool, maybe you're right, but Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter, right? And then watch meltdown ensue, right? Like, I mean, like, I feel like if I went to Ben Shapiro, and literally, he went on his whole thing, and I was just like, yeah, but,
what about Harry Potter?
Harry Potter wasn't real. And here's the thing. This is a true life story.
No one's saying Harry Potter's real.
No one's saying Wakanda's real.
Exactly.
Right? So true life story. This summer, just this summer, I went to a powerlifting meet, and it was in Kent, Ohio. Okay?
All right.
I get there early, right? And I'm warming up, and I go through the whole thing. And there's some time before I lift, so I need to go eat, right? So I'd been there for a couple hours. I had parked my car. I go to go eat. And when I wander out, there's no parking anywhere. And I'm like, oh, well, I'm glad I parked in the parking garage before all this shit happened. There's people everywhere. And I start to just follow the crowd, right? I want to see what's up. I got about an hour and a half before I have to lift. And all of a sudden, I realized I'm surrounded by people dressed as wizards with wands and glasses and staffs and, you know, and I bump into this family, and this little boy, like, hits me with a spell. Like, he said, Alakazam, Becca, boom. And I'm like, oh, holy, what happened? Am I a frog? And he was just like, no, I just put on me. Right, yeah, I guess. And, you know, so I kind of played along with it. And, you know, his parents were just, you know, they were, you know, hey, thank you for playing along and not being an asshole, basically. Because I'm wearing, I think I had a shirt with like a skull and flames and, you know, one of my lifting shirts. And, I'm going through this crowd, another little girl, and she said, are you a prince? And I said, no, sweetie, I'm definitely not a prince. I'm more like a knight. And she said, oh, knights are cool too. And I said, oh, okay, well, I like your outfit. And she's just like, oh, you want a spell? And I'm like, sure. And she's like, no, I don't give spell to boys. And then she like ran away. So, but all these kids are with their parents who are dressed.
I'm glad she said to boys.
Right. And so all these kids are dressed up. And then there were adults. There were kids from the age ranges of like 6 to like 50 dressed up as wizards, witches, and whatever the hell else. Right. And it was a Harry Potter festival. Right. It was an entire festival in Kent, Ohio for Harry Potter that drew thousands of people. Right. Now, mostly predominantly white. Right. And I've never seen Harry Potter, but I feel like there weren't
like 10 minutes of one episode.
I feel like there weren't a large number of black people in Harry Potter. You know,
I'm sure you're
maybe,
right.
Maybe there's one or two. I mean, maybe black, token. Right. Maybe they just slid someone in just to avoid controversy. But I mean, again, you know, Lord of the Rings, there were 6 of those movies or whatever between the hobbits and everything else. And there were no black hobbits and there were no black anything else. So. It happens, right? Like, I mean, sometimes you have movies that are like, it's not the end of society if we have a movie with an all black cast or all white cast or with no gays or no transgender people or all gays or whatever. I don't know. Like, I mean, like sometimes like we just want to be entertained with stories about stuff and it's not always going to encompass everybody.
And most importantly, so we were talking before the show, I was kind of going off about how the only thing that bothers me more than the political correctness movement is the people who complain so much about the political correctness movement. It's just like, I can't make a movie with all white people anymore. Yeah, you can. Relax. Yeah,
they just did. It's called Dunkirk.
Yeah. Which inserting a lot of black people in that movie would not make sense.
I just don't feel there were a lot of brothers in Dunkirk.
the Brits fighting so just the level of I'm a victim, playing the victim, white, black, whatever, has become so popular. It's so go ahead.
I get these images. There's, you know, all the different there's a ton of different memes out there that kind of encapsulate all the different types of victims, right? There's the, you know, middle-aged white guy, I'm a victim, and, you know, there's a war against white men, right?
Right.
There's that guy.
Right.
Right. But then you have, on the other end, you have the, you know, I'm a progressive feminist, I'm like a woman who's a progressive feminist. She's straight, but she's all about the LGBT movement. Right. Like, and so then there's that image. Right. And then, you know, you have your black progressives. You have your black conservatives. You have your imagery for, you know, the whole spectrum of the gay, lesbian, transgender circuit. Like there's an image I think we all have of each of those people. And every single one of them in some way, shape or form lays claim to being a victim. Now, some of them have actual legitimate claims of being a victim because they have been not only mentally and emotionally victimized, they have been in fear physical victimization, right? That is very valid, right? And then others, right? Like it's a spectrum, right? It's a sliding scale. Others don't have quite the same claim to that victimization, right? But everyone is screaming at the top of their lungs for, you know, for that same sort of validation of their victimization. And it's starting to, like, it's almost like white noise. And I think where we have to be careful
is white noise.
We have to acknowledge, we have to look at and acknowledge where real victimization happens, right? And where it's real and where it's legit, right? We can't be dismissive, especially of your unprotected, like your gay, lesbian, transgender. We have to be aware because there is a certain level of victimization that happens there with your, you know, whether it's, you know, black, Asian, Latino, what you know, pick the non-white group. Like there is some legit victimization there, right? And then with the white, the pissed off white guy, like we kind of have to, it's just like, all right, man, like I get it.
You know,
I get it. You feel left out, bro. I get it. But like, come on now.
Come on, Carl. In reality, though.
Go back to accounting, buddy.
In reality, that group has had, you know, the upper hand, for lack of a better word, for so long. And feeling that slip makes them feel like victims. I'm not saying I'm not saying that they're right.
Well, but, I mean, I don't even think it's that they. It's. I don't think that it's. They feel a slip.
Oh,
what,
I do.
What? No, I don't. I think for some of these guys, it's they just see the amount of attention that people who don't look like them are getting, and there's a difference between those two things, right? The guy is sitting there, and he doesn't necessarily feel like that guy. 5 years ago, didn't feel like he had all the power in the world, right? Because chances are, 5 years ago, he was pissed off.
He was Carl in accounting.
Right, he was Carl in accounting, and he was losing money because of all these different reasons, and, you know, the economy was tanking, and blah, 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 and you know, like, what is the government doing for me, and whatever, right? And now, all of a sudden, like, his situation is incrementally better. If not the same, then it's a little bit better or a little bit worse, one way or another. But not much has changed for him. But he sees all these other groups vying for attention, vying for something. They're asking for something. Now, what they're asking for, most of these groups are asking for equality. What they're asking for is to be seen on the same level as him.
Right.
And he doesn't necessarily see that as his power slipping. Although that, and I get what you're saying, but what he does see is like, well, my situation sucks, and nobody's really doing anything for me. And so you're going to go out, and you're going to ask for something. And I had to work to get to where I'm at, and I'm underwater with a car note and a house payment, and my wife doesn't fuck me anymore, and I hate my kids, and this guy that I'm at the bar with I can't fucking stand, but I got to drink with them because I got no other friends. And then you got Black Lives Matter and all these feminists wearing pussy hats, and you got Mexicans all over the place, and goddamn it.
And transgenders want to use the same bathroom as me.
Transgenders are trying to use the bathroom. Head explode.
Right.
You know, I mean, I don't necessarily think that they think that their stranglehold over all minority groups is slipping. I don't think that
I agree. All right, I agree with
you
that.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
Like, it's different. It's like almost the same thing, but it's different.
More like being encroached upon. They feel like their grasp of the top of the mountain is being...
No, I still don't think that's necessarily it. I think that they are... I think that there's something that... It's almost like they see other people getting stuff and no one's giving them anything.
And they think they're paying for what they get.
And they think that, right. Well, they think that.
Which is the most, oh my gosh. It's
not easy. It's complex.
And,
right?
And it's also getting fueled aggressively by Fox News and the Rush Limbaugh, the Alex Jones, my boy Ben Shapiro.
Right, and all tapped into it, right? Like, yes. And we've tapped into it. Right. I mean, so we could easily flip it and say, all right, let's delete all previous Whiskey Congress. And we're going to go, hey, this is the group that we're going to target. Pissed off white guy. We're going to target them and we're going to recruit them and we're going to feed them. And how do you do that? You just tell them because they all have this feeling, right, of sort of this emptiness, this sort of, you know, like what is going on?
I deserve better. I see on TV the Kardashians.
Right, like I feel like a hamster. I'm on the hamster wheel. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm working in this big company, or I've got this government job, and you know, I see these entrepreneurs, and I see all these stories, and blah 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 blah. Like I want to be living the good life. I want to drive a Range Rover. I want to go hunting every day, and blah blah blah, with all that other shit. And then all of a sudden, you got somebody saying, well, the reason why that's not happening is because of black people, immigrants, and gays. That's why.
Right.
That's the reason why you're stuck in your shitty job, Carl. Right. That's why you're stuck in accounting and nobody likes you, Carl. It's because of black people, immigrants, and gays. Go get them, Carl. Right. That's exactly what they're doing.
And
right.
Make them the enemy.
Right.
And then the fact that we're really dealing with a disparity of wealth distribution. But if you're angry at the black people, the Mexicans, and the gay people, then you're not going to look at the Waltons and the, you know, I mean.
And by the way, Carl, just I need you just to pay like $7.95 a month to hear us tell you who the problem is. And oh, by the way, can you buy a t-shirt and a coffee mug and a bumper sticker? We'd really appreciate it. And it's all just so we could bring you this content.
Right.
And so we could drive Range Rovers that you can afford.
Right. I mean, I heard Wayne LaPierre talking about the elites are trying to take this away from you. I'm like, Wayne, you're an elite.
Right.
You're really, really elite. And you hang out with other elites.
Do you know how much he makes a year?
I don't know. Do you know?
No, I don't.
Okay. I was just
saying. Where's your phone?
It's right here. Want to Google it?
Yeah, I want to know how much Wayne LaPierre makes. You can do two things at once.
I can.
Two things can be true at once. A couple recurring things of our show.
But if I'm Googling something, it is possible.
So I think something about the title of the show should be It's Complex and Two Things Can Be True at Once.
Our last show was called It's Complicated, so they'll be double dipping. And all right, so I'm looking for Wayne LaPierre net worth. But
moving on from that, and you can interject with
I will. Oh, don't worry. I don't mind his money situation.
We will move on from Black Panther movies kicking ass and taking names. You know, it's pissing off some white people. A very small percentage, I think. A lot of people are enjoying the movie. I will enjoy it, and I think it'll hold a special place in my heart. All things considered, you know, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, both not real. Last thing I want to talk about, Jim.
Okay, so real quick, according to Forbes, Wayne LaPierre makes about $1 million a year.
Kind of elite.
Ooh, that is a nice number.
That's a nice number. It's not starting quarterback number, but you're not.
No, it's not. It's not Ben Roethlisberger. It's not even Tyrod Taylor
money. It's a fifteenth of Tyrod Taylor money.
Oh, it's so you made 15th.
You know what? We could talk about that too, but we gotta go to the NCAA FBI scandal because that is kind of a big deal.
It is a big deal, and I'm a little bit curious on this, right? So, the NCAA and the FBI have been engaged in a probe for a while. We actually talked about this back in the fall, maybe even earlier than that, because there were this is back from 2016, maybe.
This is pre-Whiskey Congress. This is back in the old show days.
Because there has been a scandal that's been that they've been probing that deals with basically these brokers who broker deals between elite athletes, you know, high school talent, and the big name schools with the big name shoe companies, right?
Right.
And so essentially what's happening is there's a middleman who funnels the talent to the school that's connected to a particular company, whether it's Nike or Adidas or Under Armour or whoever. You have a bunch of middlemen throughout the country who are it's a little bit complicated, right? Because you get a really talented kid, let's say from Cleveland, and let's say Jim's the broker, and Jim will go to talented kid and say, Mike, I think you should go to Ohio State. Ohio State is a Nike school. And if you go to Ohio State, which is a Nike school, and based off your level of talent, you'll definitely be in the NBA. And then we can get you signed up with Nike out of the gate, and it'll be better for you and your family. And we'll get you, you know, we'll get you taken care of financially, and it all works out for everybody, right? So if they can get, if broker can get kid from, you know, whatever high school to Ohio State and sign with, which essentially signs him with Nike, then broker gets a certain amount of money, along with head coach gets a certain amount of money, right?
Yeah, they do okay. And they make more than Wayne LaPierre too.
Well, yeah, they do. So I mean, but the problem is like the coach gets paid from the school, but he also has an endorsement contract with Nike or Adidas, right, or Under Armour and all that other stuff. But you know, the coach has a vested interest, right? And, you know, drawing top talent to the school, not only to win games, but if that top talent then goes on to sign with Nike once they go pro on the next level, then the concern is that maybe there was a kickback there that the coaches were getting, right? So another thing, we had Sean Miller. Sean Miller, who... Oh, that's why, because I didn't write his name on the board.
Yeah.
Sean Miller, who's the coach of Arizona, he's on a wiretap saying that they would pay $100,000 for a kid to come to the school and get hooked up with Adidas or whoever the school sponsor is. Right. So this probe has a lot of different tentacles, and it's looking all – I mean, there's over 10 schools involved.
So I think it's like 20 to 25 schools involved.
Oh, wait, I think there's a ton of schools involved, there's a ton of actors involved, or a ton of people involved, whether they're brokers or coaches or assistant coaches, past coaches, all that other stuff. And going back to my question is the FBI's involvement.
Why are they involved?
There's, like, from a legal standpoint... Right,
this isn't about money laundering and shit like that,
well,
right?
Well, they're stretching it very far. This isn't about money laundering. How is it money laundering?
Because
you're pulling money laundering out of the air.
I forget what the...
Well, you're not forgetting. You don't know. And I'm not. And this isn't me calling you.
No. I read like what they called it, and I don't remember.
They didn't call... If people are saying money laundering and fraud... They're interjecting that themselves because that's not what's going on here, right? I think what they're doing is they're looking at the fact that how they're pulling the FBI in is that the schools deal with the federal government through grants, through loans, through different contracts.
Okay. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then it's more, it's probably more than a certain amount, right? It's probably more than like $5,000 or $10,000 or $20,000, something like that. But whatever the amount, like each of these schools, right? Like they deal with the government for more than a certain amount. Okay.
Okay.
So that then allows the FBI to come in and say, all right, well, since you're dealing with the federal government, we have jurisdiction. And somehow, they've got to be using a loose, broad rule to tie in these various brokers, coaches, all these, because NCAA violation, yes, these are all NCAA violations, but federal law violations, that's a little bit more, that's a little bit different. And those will be, depending on the attorneys who end up defending these people, because these are, you know, these are federal prosecutors. Depending on the quality of attorney for some of these people, you know, depending on how much money they got from Under Armour or Nike or whoever, they may be able to defend this okay. Because I'm not 100% sure on how they're putting this all together, and I don't think I'm alone there from a legal standpoint. I haven't seen what Jay Billis has said on this, only because I just haven't had the time to. And Jay Billis is an analyst for ESPN, but he's also an attorney, you know, who's dealt in various. I want to say white collar crime, corruption, stuff like that, or maybe it's murder. Either way, Jay Billis is an attorney who's worked for some legitimate firms. I trust his analysis. He's also a Jeezy fan.
Okay, so that helps.
And
him.
So
yeah,
I like him.
So let me throw a different. Thought out there. So I, the other day, like literally Saturday, I was walking around the house and the movie Blue Chips was on. And
random?
Well, not really, right? You've seen Blue Chips, right?
Yeah, no, okay. I've seen. Well, I guess it's that time
it's
of year.
It's about corruption in college basketball and yep. Shaq and Anthony Hardaway and Nick Nolte, and it's a fun movie, but
good
it
movie.
It shows something as so matter of fact. Because it is. To me, the players getting paid to go to certain power schools in the NCAA is like porn stars fucking Trump. We know what's happening. And frankly, I kind of don't care.
You really shouldn't.
Okay. I shouldn't be numb or shouldn't care.
No, you shouldn't be care. Or you shouldn't care.
Okay.
I have the listen. And maybe I'm biased because I was a college player, but my thought has always been this: Should colleges pay players? You know, especially the big time schools, based off the revenue that they make and blah 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 yada yada yada. No, they shouldn't. They just shouldn't, because at the end of the day, you can said it. Yeah. But, okay, fine. I will take a sip of wins.
oh, that'll teach you. For those that are regular listeners, that's a joke between Steve and I, using the expression at the end of the day.
So should they pay them? No, they shouldn't pay them, because you can't do it equitably, right? Now, you could say, well, the football team earns more than the swimming team, so the football players should be paid, right? And there's an argument for that, but the swimming team, I'm pretty sure, can bring a suit and blah, 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 and Title IX and everything else. Just save yourself all that. You're not paying the football team and the basketball team, because basically you wouldn't be paying anybody else. Or if you did, you'd have to pay everybody the same, right? And so now
final scale.
You'd have to pay everybody the same. At like everybody at one school would all have to be paid the same, right? All the scholarship athletes, or even probably even the non-scholarship athletes that pay on the team, that play on the team, would need to be paid the same across the board. And I like give me a good college player right now.
Basketball?
College football.
Sam Darnold.
All right, yeah, exactly. If I'm Sam Darnold, right, or Josh Rosen, and you're going to tell me that you're going to pay the kid on the golf team, right, the same amount as you're going to pay me, given that I play in the Rose Bowl, I play on TV, all that stuff, like, fuck out of here, right? So that would only last for so long. So don't pay the players. Like, the schools should not. But if Nike, if Under Armour, if
the local car dealership,
if Serpentini Chevrolet wants to pay a kid however much money to do, and I guess I would make certain stipulations, you can't do it during the season, right?
Why?
Like, you can't, well.
But, let's not try to break it down. The point is, these kids should not be denied from the chance to make money off of their image, name. Exactly.
If you're free market,
then you
school
should be all for this.
School shouldn't pay them. The school, like, listen, if you're giving a kid a scholarship, then you shouldn't have to worry about paying it, right?
Right.
So fine. But if the kid has an opportunity to make money because he's good at what he does, and somebody from outside of the world of college wants to pay him, then fucking let him pay him.
And if that is a swimmer who's getting a Speedo endorsement because they think he's going to be an Olympian,
fine.
Good for you.
Right, and I don't care if that, and everyone says, oh, well, then you'll have everything like it was in the 80s, right? Well, yeah, so then all of a sudden that made SMU competitive with University of Texas Texas A&M, right? And Alabama and Auburn, like, so why is that the end of the world?
And Steve, more importantly to me, we as a country and as a world would be way better off if we just started being way more honest about shit. We find so many ways to sugarcoat.
This isn't about honesty.
Hold on. Let me finish my thought.
This is about money, Jim.
Okay.
This is about keeping money.
This is about
keeping a lot of money flowing to certain people and keeping it out of the hands of other people.
Okay,
has nothing to do with the students or the players or anything like that.
When I say honesty, I mean, let's be honest about what's really happening and just accept it and move forward, rather than try to put some veil of virtue over college sports or over whatever. I mean, we make up rules to say, okay, we can't have gambling in certain places because it's not federally legal. So we'll invent an Indian, a Native American, whatever, that was there. Now it's on Native American soil in downtown Cleveland, so you can have a casino there. We make up so many bullshit rules to allow things to happen because we don't want to just honestly say, hey, people in Cleveland want to gamble. Hey, this kid coming to University of Arizona is going to bring a shit ton of money to that school, and someone's willing to pay that kid this money. So we can't let that happen, because that would be open, honest disclosure. Am I off?
It's not even open, honest disclosure. I mean, what they say is that it's not fair, right? And lots of things in this world ain't fucking fair. Exactly. Right? That's the bigger issue, is that, it's okay, it's not fair, right? Not only does the kid get to go to Duke, but he gets to go to Duke and he gets paid, right? Well, listen, if you don't pay that kid, the fact that he's going to Duke and the other kid is going to fucking Southwest, Northwest, Eastern Michigan State, I'm sorry, the kid at Duke has so many more advantages, and but at the same time, then other people right now are losing their minds, and they're just like, but systemic and not fair, and that's the whole. You know what?
Okay.
Okay.
Enough.
But with when we're talking about college sports and we're talking about sports, it just.
I guess I was trying to go bigger picture. Maybe
it's
maybe
different. I'm not. I'm just saying. Like I college sports lives in a different bubble, and sports is in a different bubble, right? And I know it drives the intellectuals crazy, and it drives the political people crazy, right? Because why do you guys care so much about sports? It's not like listen, sports has always been here. It's been here since the beginning, like since fucking gladiator days, all the way, and it's not going away.
There,
right?
The pay disparity wasn't as big a deal then, because most of them didn't survive. So.
Well, I mean, but okay, fine. But I mean, like athletes and gladiators have always had a certain
social status.
Yeah, it is absolutely. What it is, right? Like, get over it. Nobody wants to watch you do a goddamn chemistry experiment. But the point is, it's not going away. It has a place in our society, and it lives in a different bubble than everything else that you're talking about. Yes, everything else touches it. But it still exists on a different plane than the rest of these conversations. And even if we're talking about amateur sports in college, it still exists on a different plane. And this whole idea of amateurism is a pile of bullshit. It should still be, those kids should still have access to the free market. If someone wants to give them $100,000 to fucking run a football, then let that person who wants to give them $100,000 make that bad investment. And if it's a bad investment for them, they won't make it again. Or if it's a good investment, guess what they'll do? They'll keep doing it. And who does it hurt? You know, again, I mean, if you're going to sit there and tell me
totally
that, because if you're going to sit there and tell me, well, my daughter is in, you know,
the gymnastics
is going to be a teacher and she doesn't get access to that. Well, your daughter can't do any fucking thing that anybody wants to pay her for. Sorry.
Other than teach, which they'll get paid
for. Right. Like she will get paid for what anyone feels that is worth. And if there's a school out there that wants to pay her $100,000 to do it, then God bless them. But in the meantime, I'm sorry. Have a kid with better skills.
I had this conversation in college years ago when Emmitt Smith signed. Just gonna how old I am. Emmitt Smith signed the biggest contract in NFL history at the time, or maybe
I remember he back. Held out.
He did. The Cowboys, he held so out with the Cowboys. Deal. And one of my classmates said, "That's bullshit. Why are they paying him all that money?" And I said, "Because you can't get 80,000 people into a stadium to watch you and I do calculus."
Because you stole that from the program.
No, I said it long before. No, I said before the program fucking existed. I said it in 1991 or two.
No, you didn't.
What was the program? I did. No, all right, you know what? I did. I stand bullshit. By that. And then I read it. I laid in the middle of the street and I talked about it. Uh-huh. And then I replaced Omar Epps as a.
Okay.
The first part was true. The rest part, fuck you.
You replaced Omar Epps. Okay.
I did.
I'm pretty sure his eye just twitched. He's like, the fuck was that?
Somewhere in the universe. Omar Epps went, what the fuck?
Huh, that was weird.
On that note, brother, I got a comedy show to do in like half an hour, so all I got to roll.
You said you had a hard stop at 6:30. It's 6:28
on my
6:25.
All right, you want to roll for 5 more minutes?
No.
Okay, cool.
F See, you.
Hey, you know what? No, F me. By the way,
I'm standing up for Omar Epps right now. I don't want to talk to you anymore.
You're going to protest Omar Epps' mistreatment by the Whiskey Congress podcast.
I'm sorry, OE.
Which
I
you
got
can
to
find
OG.
At Whiskey Congress on Twitter. www.whiskeycongress.com. Thanks to all the folks who've been responding to us. We really appreciate it. We're doing more on YouTube. Please look for that as well. Steve, it was fun.
Yeah.
And Blanton's is fucking awesome bourbon.
I think Blanton's might have made it fun.
I think Blanton's probably
maybe,
a lot
I don't know.
All right, brother. We're out.
All right.